From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Kate Winslet. She became a star with the blockbuster Titanic, but she returned to smaller films like Hideous Kinky, Holy Smoke, and Quills, which is nominated for 3 Academy Awards. Also, I Cut Out Her Heart and Stomped on It, and other great headlines. We talk with Bill Sloan about his new History of the Tabloids. He's worked for 3 of them. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Catch All, the new CD by Swag, a group influenced by the Beatles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has approved changes in the nation's bankruptcy laws that would make it harder for people to write off their debts. Critics, including consumer groups and unions, say the bill gives lenders too much power, even those lenders who lure people into running up unsound debts. Senator Paul Wellstone, a Minnesota Democrat, said the measure would hurt ordinary people while protecting the wealthy and well-connected.
Bankruptcy has been a safety net, not just for low-income people, but for middle-income people as well. It's being shredded.
The measure has the strong support of the financial industry, which says it will prevent people from abusing the bankruptcy system. The Bush administration continues to promote tax cuts as a way to give the economy a boost, while defending itself from critics who say the president risks making things worse by repeatedly asserting that the economy is in trouble. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
With the stock market taking several steep dives this week, the president has continued to talk up his $1.6 trillion tax cut, calling it an economic recovery plan. And while his press secretary, Ari Fleischer, declines to speculate as to what's causing the turmoil in the markets, he does say that the president's comments about a sputtering economy are not scaring consumers. He says the president is merely accurately describing the economy as it is. As for the tax cut, Fleischer says it's important to have a plan to deal with the situation, and the president believes giving people some money back will provide an economic stimulus. Asked if the president's comments are meant to hint to the Federal Reserve Board that another cut in interest rates is in order, Fleischer said the president does not send signals to the Fed. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The Pentagon announced today that the United States is withdrawing about 900 U.S. troops from Bosnia. The withdrawal means the United States will be contributing less than a fifth of the total peacekeeping force in Bosnia. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
U.S. officials say the relatively peaceful conditions in Bosnia mean there's no longer a need for the heavy tanks and Apache helicopters that until now have been a part of the U.S. deployment there. The withdrawal of that equipment and the 900 or so personnel associated with it will leave the United States with just 3,500 troops in Bosnia, or about 19% of the total NATO force there. And the Bush administration may cut the U.S. deployment even more. A senior NATO official says the administration has begun sounding out U.S. allies about a plan to shift some of the peacekeeping work currently done by U.S. soldiers over to local police forces. This official says no final decisions have yet been made. A Pentagon spokesman says the administration is likely to make its Bosnia plans known within the next month or two. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
In stocks, the Dow gained 58 points to close at 10,031. The Nasdaq lost 31 points to close at 1941. This is NPR News. Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman is assuring farmers the Bush administration will work to expand overseas markets, but some producers are skeptical. Martin Wells reports from Nebraska Public Radio.
Speaking at a rural communities conference in central Nebraska today, Veneman said the Bush administration realizes farmers need to sell more crops overseas to be successful.
It is a priority of this administration to open up new markets, to negotiate additional trade agreements, and to continue expansion of our access to international markets.
But the president of the Nebraska Farmers Union calls Veneman's remarks the same old rhetoric. John Hansen points out that corn exports are at the same level in the 90s as they were in the 70s. The only difference is that corn farmers are selling their crop for less than one-third of the inflation-adjusted value. Hansen says until the government protects the value of commodities, ag producers will continue to suffer. For NPR News, I'm Martin Wells in Grand Island, Nebraska.
As Congress begins its debate on campaign finance reform, President Bush sent lawmakers a list of principles he'd like to see addressed in the legislation. The president said he wants to work with Congress for a fair and balanced bill. His outline calls for a ban on so-called soft money contributions from both corporations and unions. President Bush also wants to require unions to get the permission of their members and corporations to get the permission of their shareholders before they make political contributions. He called for a boost in the limits on individual donations that were put in place more than 20 years ago. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 7 points to close at 1,174. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, featuring the Unlimited Advantage, brokerage service that lets investors consult, plan, invest, and bank. 1-800-MERRILL or askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kate Winslet, is known around the world for her starring role in the blockbuster Titanic, but it's not typical of the kind of film she makes. She made her screen debut in the 1994 film Heavenly Creatures, based on the true story of two teenage girls with an obsessive friendship who murdered one of their parents who tried to separate them. Winslet has also starred in several literary adaptations, Sense and Sensibility, Jude, based on Jude the Obscure, and Hamlet, directed by Kenneth Branagh. Her latest film, Quills, is very loosely based on the life of the Marquis de Sade, from whose writings about sex and pain we get the word sadism. The film is nominated for 3 Academy Awards, including Best Actor for Jeffrey Rush's portrayal of de Sade. In the film, de Sade has been institutionalized in a mental asylum. His books remain very popular, even though they've been banned in France. Kate Winslet plays the asylum laundress who smuggles out his writings to his publisher.
Your publisher says I'm not to leave without another manuscript.
Just the story. Inspired by these very surroundings. The unhappy tale of a virginal laundry lass. The darling of the lower wards where they entomb the criminally insane.
Is it awfully violent?
Most assuredly.
Terribly erotic.
Fiendishly so. But it comes with a price. A kiss for each page.
Must I administer them directly or might I blow them?
The price, my coquette, is every bit as firm as I am.
Oh, you. You talk the same as you write.
Kate Winslet, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You've done several risky things during your film career. Did this seem like an adventurous or risky film to make?
It was both, I think, adventurous and risky, which is really the reason why I wanted to do it. I think it was just such a brave and bold script, and particularly because it had been written by a first-time features writer, I was just so amazed at the sort of daring aspects that the script had, and it just seemed so accomplished to me as well. It was really well written and just had so much stuff in there that as an actor you can really get your teeth into.
What was the riskiest part for you in making the film?
Well, I just think the subject matter was really the riskiest thing, because it's just something that, for a start, not many people know about. And you know, you take a lot of chances when you play with history in the way that we were. And you know, the Marquis de Sade, he's not the type of character that everybody loves. So that aspect was, you know, I think probably the hardest. And there were specific scenes that were tough as well. But you know, working with people like Jeffrey Rush and Joaquin Phoenix and Michael Caine, I was kind of in a position where I sort of couldn't go wrong, because they were just so great, and Philip Kaufman is such an amazing director.
When you talk about risky scenes, are you thinking perhaps of the scene where you're laying naked in the chapel and Joaquin Phoenix, who plays a priest who is in love with you, makes love to your dead body?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That'll fall in the category.
That springs to mind. That's certainly one of the ones that springs to mind. No, that was a difficult... I mean, it was harder for Joaquin, I think, that scene. It's a deeply emotional scene for him. And, of course, for me, I mean, nudity is always tough to do, and it never gets any easier, and I don't like doing it. But, you know, it's sometimes very much a part of the story and often really crucial to the story, to the storyline and to the character's journey. So you kind of have to just accept that and move on. But, you know, when you're shooting scenes like that, you have to keep a sense of humour, and everyone's always so sensitive towards what you're having to do that, you know, it makes life a lot easier. But that certainly was a difficult one, because, as I said, it was so hard on Joaquin. He had to just cry continuously for an entire day, and the poor guy was just so exhausted at the end of it. But that's, yes, that's one of the ones that's, you know, top of the list of tough scenes in Quills.
What's difficult about doing a nude scene?
Well, you know, if you were in a restaurant and someone turned around to you and said, take all your clothes off and stand up on the table, would you do it? It sort of feels like that. You know, it's very, very hard. You know, you are naked and vulnerable in front of a bunch of people who you have got to know a little bit, but essentially don't know. You know, these people aren't your friends. They're not people you would necessarily trust on a day-to-day real life basis, and obviously making movies is great, but it isn't reality, and you have to remember that. So it is just hard, you know, overcoming any, you know, fears that you might have about your own physicality and so on. And the toughest part really is forgetting that you're naked, because in order to make scenes like that work, and in order to get the acting of the scene across, you have to completely abandon any fears that you may have about, you know, your physical body shape, and just get on with the work and try and do the best work that you possibly can in a really bizarre situation. That for me is always the hardest part, is just concentrating on the work and forgetting about everything else.
Kate Winslet is my guest. Usually after someone's been in a big blockbuster like Titanic, they keep making big expensive movies, and you've stuck with more arty films and independent films. There's Quills, Hideous Kinky, Holy Smoke. Why have you made those choices instead of going with, you know, the big box office type films?
Well, it's really interesting when people ask me this question, because it hasn't been a deliberate decision that I've made. And in a way, if you think about the films that I've done in my career, movies like Heavenly Creatures, and even Sense and Sensibility, Jude, Hamlet, you know, they are kind of small movies. And so, in a way, I'm always somehow drawn to that. And really with Titanic, what happened was I remember reading the script and just loving it so much and loving the character. And Jim Cameron, I really believe, is a genius. And I just thought to myself, well, why not? You know, it had all of the elements that I usually hope to find when I'm reading movie scripts, and it just so happened to be a huge, great big hit. So after Titanic, I didn't really make a conscious decision to steer clear of all the great big blockbuster movies. I mean, I was very aware of the fact that it was important not to continue to do big movie after big movie, because I didn't want people to get bored of me for a start, and I also wanted to remember that, you know, I'm doing this because I love it and not for any other reason, and it was important for me to just kind of keep reminding myself of that fact. Hideous Kinky was a very conscious decision that I made. I wanted to do a lovely little British movie, just something that was a complete contrast to the enormity of Titanic, and I'd always loved the story. Hideous Kinky is an adaptation of a novel, and I'd read the novel when I was about 17 years old, so it was sort of kind of special to me to make that film. And, you know, it was great. I got to go to Morocco and get a suntan, and I met my husband there, so I think that was probably a good choice to have made.
Right. Let me ask you about your first film, Heavenly Creatures. Now, this is about two teenage girls who are best friends, and you have a very vivid imagination and lead all these fantasy games. Mm-hmm. This is based on the true story of two girls who shared a love of fantasy and literature. And when they learn that one of them is going to leave New Zealand with her family, and her friend can't go with her, they conspire to kill the friend's mother, who they blame for trying to end their intense and obsessive relationship with each other. In this scene, the two girls have planned to buy tickets so they can leave New Zealand together. One calls the other to say she's almost got the money together.
Everything's going to be okay, Gina. Mr. Paris promised to give me £50 for my horse.
That's 120. Just another £30 and we've got the fare.
It's no bloody good. I went to the passport office today. They won't give me one till I'm 20.
But that's not true. I've got one.
No. I need my sodding parents' consent.
Oh, don't cry, Gina. Gina, please don't cry. We're not going to be separated. We're not.
They can't make us.
They can't! They can't!
Kate Winslet, how did you get this part in the movie?
I was just sitting there actually listening to that clip, and I know every single word, every single line that was said then, including mine and Melanie Linsky's, who played Pauline. Every single line I can still remember. It's amazing. I was just saying that because I'm sure I couldn't remember the lines from all the other movies that I've done, but I think Heavenly Creatures was so special to me, and I felt so close to it. I still remember things as though it was yesterday.
You were, 17 when you had that role?
I was 17, yes. I was just 17, actually, when I played that part. I got the part because Peter Jackson, who had directed it, and Fran Walsh, his co-writer, they were after an English girl because she was English, and she was living in New Zealand with her family. So they appointed UK casting directors John and Roz Hubbard, whom I've known for a long time anyway, and I'd known them for a little while even back then. And I was just called in to audition. I was sent the script and called in to audition, and I remember being very, very determined and thinking, you know, if it's the last thing I do, I'm going to get this. I just loved the script so much, and I really understood these girls, the intensity of their relationship. I mean, I'd never had a relationship like that myself, but that sort of heightened sense of reality and that kind of hormonal confusion that young girls go through, because I was so close to it, or I had been through it, you know, a couple of years earlier, I really, really related to it, and just their commitment and loyalty and love that they had for each other, I just thought was so amazing, and was only too thrilled when they called me when I was working in a deli in Reading, which is my hometown, and I received a phone call from my agent saying, "You clever girl, you've got the job," and I just screamed and cried and had to be sent home. I was completely hopeless. Couldn't make any more sandwiches that day.
My guest is Kate Winslet. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kate Winslet. When we left off, we were talking about her first film, Heavenly Creatures. This is a disturbing film. You know, the two girls end up killing one of the girls' mothers. So, you know, a lot of teenagers start making movies in teen prank and sex movies. Did you ever like those kind of teen movies? You never were
no.
in any of them.
No, I wasn't. I'd never really had any kind of interest in movies like that, to be honest with you. But it's interesting because when I was very young and realized that I definitely wanted to be an actress, I never for one minute even thought about movies, films. It never even occurred to me, because I had grown up in a family of actors who worked sometimes and had long periods of time when they didn't work and would get part-time jobs in between and would mostly do theatre and TV, but none of them ever really did film. So I just always assumed that would be the type of career that I would have. And, you know, I got so sick of people saying to me, you know, "You really need to have another string to your bow, Kate. You know, it's a very hard life, you know, that an actor leads, and, you know, you might not work all the time, and maybe you should do a secretarial course." And I remember really panicking about this, because I never did that. I never had the other string to my bow. I always figured that if it didn't work out, I would just have to find something else to do and make that happen. But I never thought about being in films. And so when I was sent this script for Heavenly Creatures, it was only after reading it once that I then suddenly realized, God, this is a movie. You know, I could do a movie, God. And it really hit me that was a possibility all of a sudden. I'd never thought that before. For some reason, I'd never thought that before. And even as we were making the movie, I didn't really think about what was going to happen with it and whether people would actually see it. I was doing a movie, and that was great, you know. I just didn't think about what would happen later. I just wanted to have the best time I could and work as hard as I could. And, you know, and the result was quite a nice one, really.
Acting has been a part of your family life. Your grandparents on your mother's side ran a small theater. Your father was or still is an actor.
Was and, you know, is now sort of doing other things. I mean, he's getting on a bit. He'd hate me to say that, but... He's always doing lots of things, my dad.
Tell me about your grandparents' theatre.
My grandparents ran the old Reading Repertory Theatre Company, and what that means is that there was a group of actors who were a part of this theatre company, and they would literally rotate and role plays over just back to back to back. And the theatre was in my grandparents' back garden, so my mother very much grew up with actors just, you know, walking through the house every now and then and being in the kitchen, just being around. And it was very much a part of her life and sort of spilled over into our lives as well, although my mother herself doesn't act. It was kind of coincidental and a bit crazy that my father did. So it just became one big actory fest, you know, and there was no escaping, I don't think, for myself and my sisters. We always knew that was what we wanted to do. I mean, we had no idea whether it would work out or not, but it was what we wanted to do, and we felt kind of really strongly about that.
Was your father maybe able to make a living as an actor, and what did you think of the profession watching him trying to make it?
Well, I always respected my dad so much because he did always work and he worked really hard, but he would be doing theatre or little TV jobs or, you know, going away, travelling, touring theatre all over the UK. And I was always so proud of that. And there was nothing, you know, it was so thrilling to go and see him on stage and, you know, just go, oh, that's my dad. You know, it was just fantastic, a fantastic feeling. So, yes, he did make a living. I mean, it was really hard, but especially having four children, it was tough. But yes, he did make a living. And I wanted to be like him. I just wanted to have as much determination as he had, and I wanted to work as much as he did and have such a great time as well. I mean, he always had so much fun. So that was, you know, that was what I grew up on, you know, just seeing him work hard and having great fun at the same time. That was a real inspiration to me, because it is important to remember that you mustn't take it too seriously, and you know, it isn't reality, and of course it's wonderful, but you just have to remember to go home and have your life at the end of every day.
Now, I know men and women, and I'll include myself in this category, who really think that it's great that you're this beautiful actress who isn't rail thin.
Oh, it's that subject. Oh.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all. It's to be expected, let's say.
Yeah,
but
well,
that's fine. It's fine.
I'm just wondering how, if... I read about you, I read that there was a period of your life when you were around 18, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have it right. When you were really working hard to be as thin as you could and develop something of an eating disorder, what were the pressures that led to that?
There weren't any pressures, to be honest. I mean, it hadn't really... No one had ever said to me, oh, you've got to get thin. You know, no one ever said that to me. I just got caught in a trap of having been really quite big when I was about 15 years old. I was weighing around 13 stone, which is about 185 pounds, at the age of 16. So, you know, I needed to do something. And I knew that as an actress, there were only certain roles that I was going to get at that age if I was overweight. And I really was overweight. I mean, I was fat, basically. I wasn't even shapely. And I wasn't happy. It wasn't making me happy. So I very sensibly lost some of that weight and just got down to, I don't know what weight it was, but, you know, a good average weight. And then I just got carried away, really. I just got carried away, and I just thought, well, you know, the thinner I get, the nicer clothes I'll be able to wear, and I might get more jobs if I'm really skinny, and people might like me more, and people might think I'm more attractive, and just completely corrupt, totally corrupt. But no, it was all self-inflicted. No one had pushed me into this at all. And, yeah, I did get really quite thin, and, you know, I would faint and things and just didn't eat very much at all. I mean, I think about it now and I can't believe how stupid I was to let myself get like that. I mean, I was never emaciated, and, you know, and I wouldn't say to this day that I had a major eating disorder, because I didn't need to seek help and I sorted it out for myself. I was strong enough to be able to do that. Now, some people aren't strong enough to be able to do that, but I'm just lucky that I was. But there was a period of a couple of months that went by when I remembered, you know, I just hardly ate a thing. And that's just so bad for you, so bad for you. So I'm lucky that I pulled myself out of it, and I've been the shapely girl I am ever since.
I'm wondering if, having gone through that, if it affected your self-consciousness on screen at all.
Not really. I mean, you'd think that maybe it would, but I'm just, you know, I'm self-conscious in a very natural way, you know, in the way that we all are, like, oh, I don't like that wobbly bit there, or must remember to hold my stomach in, you know, oh, you know, do my breasts look saggy? You know, I think those are normal thoughts to have, especially when you are an actress who has to agree to nudity on screen. And all those very natural paranoias can't help but run through your mind.
So what movie is coming up for you next?
Well, I shot a movie, Enigma, last year, which Michael Apted directed with Dougray Scott. That's based on a novel by Robert Harris. It's about the breaking of the Enigma codes in the Second World War. So I shot that while I was pregnant, actually. I was 5-6 months pregnant when we had finished shooting the movie. I believe that's coming out Easter summer. I'm not quite sure. And then I'm going to be shooting a movie with Judi Dench in about a month's time called Iris, which is about the life of Iris Murdoch, who died sadly of really chronic Alzheimer's, and I'm playing the young Iris. I'm playing the young Judi Dench, and I'm quite keen to get back to work actually after having had the baby, and I really thought I'd just want to take, you know, forever off and never go back to work, but about a month ago I just felt a little bit itchy to, you know, to do something, and this is great, you know, because half the movie is set in the present and half of it is in the past, so it's not as intense as most shoots would be, so it'll just be nice to kind of, you know, get my teeth into something and just ease me back into it gently, because I haven't really done anything for almost a year now with having the baby, so it'll be good to get back there.
Well, I wish you the best with it, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Kate Winslet, her latest film, Quills, has been nominated for 3 Academy Awards. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, I watched a wild hog eat my baby. We talk with Bill Sloan about his new history of the tabloids. He was an editor at the National Enquirer, Midnight, and the National Tatler. And Ken Tucker reviews Catch All, the new CD by Swag, a group influenced by the Beatles.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The sex lives and diets of celebrities are the stock and trade of today's tabloids. In earlier decades, the headlines were more like, a violent cannibal kills pal and eats pieces of his flesh, 3,000-year-old man brought back to life, and girl raped by abominable snowman gives birth to a hideous beast child. I Watched a Wild Hog Eat My Baby is a new book about the history of the tabloids. The author, Bill Sloan, worked for the tabloids in the 60s and 70s. He was an editor at the National Enquirer, Midnight, which became Globe, and the National Tattler. He started his career as a reporter for the Dallas Times-Herald. I asked him about some of the best stories he was involved with at the tabloids.
Some of the most memorable stories that I was involved with back in the late 60s and early 70s were stories about Jackie Onassis. And the Enquirer, where I was working then, was absolutely fascinated with Jackie and everything that was going on in her life, and that we tried to get her on the cover as many times as we could, because our sales always seemed to jump dramatically when we had a Jackie story out there.
When you joined the Enquirer in, was it 1968?
Yes.
The Enquirer was reworking its image. What had its image been? How was it changing?
Well, it had been known as the goriest, most scurrilous publication in probably in the history of American journalism, because of all the really gory and grotesque crime coverage that it specialized in. And in late 1967, they began, Mr. Pope, the founder and publisher of the paper, began to pull away from this because he wanted to get it into supermarkets, because he felt that that was the only way he could continue to sell in big numbers. The mom and pop corner stores and the old newsstands, downtown newsstands, were going out of business pretty rapidly then, and he decided that supermarkets was the way to market a tabloid, and he was absolutely correct, as later developments proved. But he knew he had to clean up his act in order to get accepted by the supermarkets, and so he very abruptly, really, at least to a lot of observers, he phased out the gory crime and turned the Enquirer into a squeaky clean sort of Reader's Digest in tabloid form. And it was at the height of this, you know, cleanup period that I joined the Enquirer.
What was an example of the type of gory story that he wanted to now keep out of the paper, that he used to publish and then changed his mind about?
Well, I think the most notorious story headline that ever ran in the Enquirer, it was, "I Cut Out Her Heart and Stomped on It." And it was a story about the mutilation slaying of an Olympic skier named Sonia McCaskey. And the cover, along with that headline, actually showed her severed head or heart and her hand and other parts of her body. And this is the type of thing that the Enquirer specialized in. Morgue photos of accident victims and murder victims, and they didn't hold anything back.
Was this a real photo of her, or was it...
Oh, no, it was an absolutely authentic photo. All these pictures were authentic because there were people, photographers with police departments and newspapers around the country, who were willing to sell this type of material to the Enquirer, and Pope paid pretty well for it.
So did his scheme work in terms of changing the content of the Enquirer in order to get it at the checkouts?
Yes, it did. It worked out very well. And but the Jackie O thing began a gradual approach toward more and more celebrity stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you see in today's tabloids. They're very, very heavy on celebrity. I mean, you see a few human interest stories or gee whiz stories tucked in here and there, but they're at least 75% to 80% celebrity, and at that time they were not. They were, celebrities were part of a very calculated mix that included medicine and science and social issues and I don't know, there was a list of about 35 or 40 categories that we tried to fill in every issue.
Now, one of the tabloids has a kind of different kind of cover right now than the celebrity-oriented gossip type, and this is The Sun, where the cover is look and feel 15 years younger in just 2 weeks. And there's a picture of, a man and a woman both looking, I don't know, mid-50s to late 50s, wearing kind of pastel leisure clothes, jumping up with their arms over their head in this real, like, yeah, feel good type of position. And that's not a Tom Cruise or, you know, Bill Clinton sex scandal kind of headline.
No. The Sun and the News of the World, which is was a companion publication of the Enquirer before all the tabloids were bought out by the same publishing company. These are what I've loosely called lunatic fringe tabloids. They specialize in end-of-the-world stories. I mean, if you can have one of those every week, that's basically what they want to do. And spiritual themes. I know the man very well who was the mastermind behind The Sun. He was also the co-founder of Midnight, which is now Globe, and later edited The Examiner, John Vader, and he has an imagination like nothing I've ever encountered before.
Actually, you say in your book that John Vader has been called the mad genius of the tabloids. What did he do to earn that title?
Well, I think the story and the headline that perhaps illustrates his madness and his genius best is one that ran in the early 70s and was purportedly a photograph of JFK in a wheelchair, obviously, you know, in a semi-vegetative state, and the headline said JFK is alive on Scorpios. Now, when I talked to John a year ago, just about, he told me how that story came together, and it was they took a member of the Midnight staff. The paper was published in Montreal at that time, and they went up on top of Mount Royal just as the sun was going down, and they got this guy posed in a wheelchair with his robe pulled up around him, where all you could really see was his profile, and he did have a very Kennedy-esque profile. And they made some pictures of him, and John had been thinking about this, he told me, for months, maybe even years, the idea that JFK had somehow survived the shooting in Dallas and was living on Scorpios or living someplace in seclusion and being taken care of by Jackie and Onassis. And the paper just sold gangbusters. I think it was one of the largest selling issues in Midnight's history. So this is an example of the kind of thing he was doing.
My guest is Bill Sloan, the author of I Watched a Wild Hog Eat My Baby, A History of the Tabloids. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Sloan, and he's written a cultural history of the tabloids. It's called I Watched a Wild Hog Eat My Baby. And he wrote and edited for three different tabloids, The Enquirer, The Tatler, and Midnight, which became The Globe. And he did that in the late 60s and early 70s. Let's get back to Gene Pope, Jr., who founded The Enquirer, the National Enquirer. You describe him as the father of the modern supermarket tabloid.
Right.
Now, his father, how did his father make his fortune?
Well, his father was an Italian immigrant who came to this country in 1904, and he went to work for a sand and stone company in New York City, which had a lot of large contracts with the city of New York. And I think that was he later took over the company. He became an executive and as I understand it, saved the company from bankruptcy and later took control of it. He also bought and published an Italian language newspaper in New York called Il Progresso, which was at the time the largest Italian language publication in the U.S. He had his finger in a lot of pies, and he was very closely aligned with a number of high-ranking mafia figures, including Frank Costello, who was Gene Pope Jr.'s godfather.
And Gene Pope Sr. supported Mussolini.
Yes, he did. He was a very ardent and outspoken supporter of Mussolini. He went to went back to Italy after Mussolini took power and had a face-to-face meeting with Il Duce, and was very impressed by the man. And he openly supported and editorially supported Mussolini in Il Progresso until the virtual eve of World War II, when he finally denounced fascism editorially in his paper.
So why did Gene Pope Jr. decide to start a tabloid?
I'm not sure. I think he had a grand plan, even as a young man, and he was obviously from a wealthy family, but he was more or less estranged from that family at the time. He was looking around for something to put his genius to work on, and he found a down-at-the-heels New York Sunday newspaper called the New York Inquirer, which ironically had been established by a close associate of William Randolph Hearst back in the 20s. And he bought the paper for a reputed price of $75,000, and it was virtually defunct. It was virtually out of business. The circulation was down to about 17,000, and it was deeply in debt, which he didn't find out until after he bought it. And the way he managed to salvage the paper and make it profitable, first of all, was through cash infusions from Frank Costello, who at that time was the acknowledged leader of the New York Mafia.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Sloan, and he's the author of the new book, I Watched a Wild Hog Eat My Baby, A History of the Tabloids and Their Cultural Impact. And he worked for the tabloids in the late 60s and early 70s. He worked for three of them. What are some of the tricks of the trade that you learned while you were working for the tabloids? How to take a small story and make it really big, blow it out of proportion, put in innuendo that wasn't really there, or allege something that didn't really happen?
Well, of course, as a writer for the Inquirer, I was not allowed to deviate very much from the source material that the articles editor provided for me. So it was really a matter of writing style more than anything else, and tabloids were written in a terse, punchy way that very short sentences. It was, to a very large extent, it was the kind of writing that I had been taught should be practiced by daily newspapers. But daily newspapers have tended to get away from that style, especially in recent years, and get very complex with the way they approach a story, particularly with their analytical stuff. But short sentences, you know, no more than 8 or 10 words, short paragraphs, get to the point, rock 'em, sock 'em, this type of thing, I think is what the tabloids specialized in and what made them so appealing to their readership.
You know, we were talking about some of the tricks of the trade. And one of them that you describe in your book is something that John Vader, the co-founder of Midnight, which became the Globe, told you about. And tell the story about the story behind Elvis founded motel room with six girls at once.
Yeah, right. Well, this was really pretty simple, and it was also ingenious. John would just go to a cheap motel in the Montreal area and sign Elvis's name to the register. And then he would manufacture a story about Elvis having been there in, you know, a sexually compromising situation. And he would have the register with Elvis's name on it as documentation. That was all the documentation he needed.
Now, my guess would be that there are certain stories in the tabloids you can't run unless you have a photo to go along with it, because the photo is going to sell the story. Is that right?
Well, stories are often written to go with photos, but if you have a good story...
Oh, I see. So the photo often comes first.
Yeah, the photo often comes first, and if you have a good story, you can always come up with stock photos to illustrate it.
Right.
I remember where the story's about Monica and Clinton and Hillary and the first family. All these scandalous stories were illustrated with stock pictures that, you know, had been run. I mean, all the agencies had them. There was nothing incriminating or insinuating about the photos at all, but they just, you know, they would maybe have a certain expression on their face, a look of maybe a little bit of a shocked look, or they would be looking unhappy or something of that nature, and they would just use those to illustrate the story. I remember a story about Monica contemplating suicide, and, you know, they had this this sad-looking picture of Monica. I don't know where it came from, but obviously it had nothing to do with the story. It was just a stock picture.
I would imagine that if a celebrity is giving a friend a hug at a restaurant, that could suddenly be transformed into a secret affair discovered at restaurant.
Oh, absolutely.
Rex marriage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, they can read sinister things into the most innocent picture. I remember a picture that was running Globe back during the presidential campaign of George W. Bush holding a glass with some liquid in it. Now, I don't know what the glass contained, but to the tabloid editor who saw the picture, he immediately thought that, you know, oh, boy, this is evidence that Bush has fallen off the wagon, you know, and this appeared on the cover of Globe. This is the type of thing they do.
Did you pay sources when you were working for the Tabs?
I never personally paid sources, but Generoso Pope approved payments to sources all the time.
How do you feel about that, coming from a newspaper background in which you do not pay sources?
Well, it's not totally ethical as far as I'm concerned, but I understand why the tabloids do it. And if they're paying a source who provides legitimate material, legitimate information that nobody else has, then, you know, I can see some justification for their doing it, especially in the highly competitive situation that they find themselves in now, with the mainstream media going so sensational and so tabloidish on their own. The Enquirer developed a lot of information in the O.J. Simpson case that nobody else had, and they did it almost entirely with checkbook journalism. But if they had not paid these sources, this information would never have come to light.
But it's so confusing because, you know, that mix, it mixed in with some of the accurate stuff in the tabloids is so much inaccurate stuff that it's impossible for a reader to distinguish which is which.
It often is. It often is.
It kind of soils all the information.
It does. It really does. And this is why the tabloids still have the image of being sleazy, scurrilous publications. And in some ways, they are.
You say that the tabloids are really in trouble now. Their circulations are down. Why? Why are they having trouble?
Well, I think that the main reason they're having trouble is because sensationalism has been discovered and embraced enthusiastically by the mainstream media, not just the print media, but the electronic media as well. And the tabloids only come out once a week. The daily papers come out every day, obviously, and radio and television can air a story within minutes after it develops. And so with all the, one of the worst things that has happened to the tabloids in recent years is the scandal involving Bill Clinton, because the daily papers and television were absolutely beating the story to death, and they weren't leaving the tabloids anything new to come out with. I think this is one reason that they had to resort to those, you know, Hillary's secret diary type stories.
What do you think the tabloids are trying to do now to boost their circulation?
Well, I think they're trying a lot of things, but I think that basically they're really grasping at straws. They're trying to keep the hot celebrity stuff on the covers, and But if you'll notice, a lot of the celebrity stories the tabloids run today are really complimentary stories. They're, you know, they're gossipy, but there's no scandal involved. There's not much zip to them. I don't know what the tabloids are going to do. I think that really that they are grasping at straws, and I don't think they know themselves how to reverse this downward trend in circulation, which, by the way, has been going on ever since the mid-1980s.
Well, Bill Sloan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been my pleasure.
Bill Sloan is the author of I Watched a Wild Hog Eat My Baby, A History of the Tabloids. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by Swag. This is Fresh Air. The recent success of an anthology of the Beatles' number one hit singles has made rock critic Ken Tucker more aware of the number of current bands influenced by the Fab Four. The best one he's come up with is Swag, a side project by members of groups as various as Wilco, Cheap Trick, and the Mavericks. Swag's CD is called Catch All, which Ken says pretty much sums up its eclectic music.
If you believe, as I do, that the Beatles made the most purely pleasurable body of rock music in the history of the form, then the countless number of bands who have echoed, aped, stolen, or mangled their style can be sources of both annoyance and pleasure. There are times when you say, oh, come on, can't we get past the 500th variation on Ticket to Ride or I Am the Walrus? And at other times, as on Swag's I'll Get By, you just give yourself over to the music and let the warmth of Beatle love these musicians possess radiate through you as well. On that particular cut, I also hear the influence of other 60s acts such as the Zombies and the Bo Brummels. So who are these swaggerers? They include the drummer from Wilco, Ken Coomer, Cheap Trick's bassist Tom Peterson, and two members of the Mavericks, Jerry Dale McFadden and Robert Reynolds. The Mavericks is ostensibly a country act, and Swag cut its CD in Nashville, but it might as well have been recorded in an Abbey Road recording studio with a song such as Different Girl.
Maybe. Are hidden well, but I can't.
Is there anything more to this music than the sound of disparate musicians getting together to recreate a sound and time that seems at once impossibly over and forever present in our collective mind? I think I've answered my own question by asking it. Anytime you create a paradox like that, a kind of nostalgia that isn't marred by sentiment, that gains strength from the enduring vitality of certain chords and certain harmonies, you're making worthwhile music. I've been wasting my days around this place. Some hearts never change, they just seem strange. But I'm doing my best to shake this in blue. Yeah. I go thinking about them. If only all the kids and baby boomers who bought the recent Beatles collection called One were to buy Swag's catch-all as well, the kind of power pop many of us have enjoyed in 100 different obscure acts would be in great shape. It's a dream, but good creative dreaming is part of what this kind of music is meant to inspire.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Catch-All by Swag. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Do you want to take a Sunday trip?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Bibliotherapy, The Girl's Guide to Books for Every Phase of Our Lives by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of the group Aerosmith and Paul Simon. Next week, they'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Jerry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. There was a time when I was so brokenhearted, love wasn't much of a friend of mine.